Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer and host of the series. This episode is The Green New Deal, a panel from the 2019 Left Forum. The panelists are Max Eil, spelled A-J-L, and Kali Akuno. You can find Essential Dissent on YouTube, Facebook, and iTunes, and you can download the audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, all.net. And now, the Green New Deal.
I'm Max Eil, and I am study sociology and have been active in the Palestine movement and also in the environmental movement. Kali, most of you know Kali, who founded Cooperation Jackson, has been very active speaking out about issues involving ecology, the Green New Deal, and a just transition. So I'm going to speak a little bit about the general context, about why we are discussing the Green New Deal in the first place, some of the forces at play, and how we might approach it as independent leftists. And then Kali is going to offer a different interpretation of some similar topics and some of the different topics. So first is context. Why are we discussing the Green New Deal? This is not, I think, solely due to Ocasio-Cortez raising the issue. If you look at the climate reports, they have been raising the alarm not only about the severity of the climate crisis and the broader ecological crisis within which it is embedded, but also they have been raising the issue that you actually need a structural transformation of the economic system, which doesn't mean a structural transformation towards a more egalitarian or non-hierarchical social system or what people in the past and present understand as communism or socialism. It just means that people understand that a system based on limitless extraction is physically destroying the environment, and that actually imperils everybody, including the very wealthy. So there's a much broader context within which a conversation about the Green New Deal is able to appeal to a wide segment of the U.S. and indeed the world population, right? I mean, it's worth keeping in mind that the first discussion of the Green New Deal came from Thomas Friedman, who has a very different vision of society than probably most of the people in this room, right? He actually doesn't think people in the Middle East should have societies. They should be kind of like destroyed wastelands. So we need to keep in mind that this is an idea that does not contain a specific politics. It's, in fact, an idea that represents a battleground, as does the entire environmental crisis writ large. So this has to be the starting point for understanding why we're discussing it and why there's so many distinct forces at play who are trying to put their brand on the Green New Deal and structure the Green New Deal in the way that they think will best represent their interests and constitute a new society. This brings us to the question of the Green New Deal as a battlefield. Is the Green New Deal, is it policy or is it politics? So, of course, the Ocasio-Cortez plan suddenly put in place a lot of ideas for clean transition, upgrading of renewables, and a new industrial strategy, talked somewhat less or not at all about the Global South, did talk about frontline communities, but in what I would argue are very deliberately vague ways. Nevertheless, this did do a good service in suddenly propelling the issue of climate change into the mainstream of both elite discussion and also popular discussion. So there is a mounting urgency about the issue of climate change, which everyone, of course, I think both appreciates and those who don't appreciate need to appreciate, because climate change is pretty much a fait accompli. Like, it's already destroying everything. You know, you can read in the paper today that Chennai is actually out of water because of a historic drought. 4 years ago, it was actually suffering historic floods. And this is because everything is out of kilter, because the monsoons came too intensely and there wasn't an ability to absorb the water. And now the monsoons are too late. And so the historic patterns that allow some form of civilization in places like the Global South are actually collapsing right now. Not yesterday, and they aren't collapsing in 10 years with this 10-year horizon that's put in place for talking about climate change. No. Already the disaster is hitting the Global South today. Now, there's a lot of forces that are putting a lot of proposals into place. So you can see a wide range of things, ranging from kind of the most right-wing to the most left-wing. So you see, for example, there's think tanks in Australia called the Breakthrough Institute. Any institute called Breakthrough should set off an alarm bell, because they're all funded by the same people, and what they want to do is break the system and put in place a new one. They are saying that there needs to be an arrangement between the national security state, businesses, and what they call communities in order to put in place a system, a more sustainable system of economic production and consumption, right? So they are well aware of it because Australia is very close to Southeast and South Asia, and they're going to have to deal with floods of immigration that they are incapable structurally of dealing with. So they're like, okay, we need to stabilize the system in order so that our system of accumulation here in Australia can continue. And they're willing to use the national security state to do so, right? So this is basically an argument for a form of fascism. You have more kind of conventional, what are seem conventional arguments from people like Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren is like, okay, we can use the opportunity of the Green New Deal to set in place a new system of clean tech export. So basically, what she wants to do is relaunch a new industrial revolution based on clean tech and based on the advantages the U.S. would supposedly have to export clean tech technology to Europe and also especially the global south. So this is basically continuing capitalist imperialist industrial supremacy based on a new form of technology that hopefully won't destroy the climate as much as the current system is doing. That's another option, the Warren option. Then there are the options coming from Ocasio-Cortez. Now, what's worth keeping in mind is that actually, you know, she put out the initial resolutions in February, and it's already basically July. There's still no details about that. And so we don't know about it, which doesn't actually, I don't think that means we should think of it as a blank slate upon which we can put whatever we want. There was a decision clearly to not put out more details yet. Why that decision was made, we really don't know yet. But, you know, this isn't happening by clumsiness. We can also consider that the New Consensus, which is actually the think tank that designed the idea of the Green New Deal, what they said is that they want to put in place a governing domestic agenda and to see the elephant hole. So basically, it's somewhat similar to what Elizabeth Warren said. They want to reconstruct the U.S. economic system and put in place basically what I think would argue is a new system of hierarchy. Okay, so this brings us to the third question, which is, I think, a very important question for us in this room, which is how we think of the Green New Deal and how we can think of it on independent terms. So is the Green New Deal something that politicians and whatever academics they want to purchase come up with, craft, and then we want to lobby them to make it a little better, to include a few more frontline communities in the United States, to maybe not hit India and North Africa quite as hard, so that some of the clean tech becomes grants instead of sales? Is that the kind of system we wish to aspire to? Is it a system in which we want to basically lobby the existing forces to put in place a somewhat better Green New Deal than they would put in of their own accord? That is one option, right? And that is the option that is kind of the historic approach of lobbying the Democratic Party for some kind of measure of inclusion within their policy agenda. Another idea, of course, is, which I think is the idea I advocate, is to actually say, okay, the Green New Deal is enormously popular. 70% of the U.S. population wants a Green New Deal, and that is something we should definitely get behind, not only because the climate crisis is already destroying the planet, but actually because there's a much wider ecological crisis, right? Biodiversity is actually collapsing, and we don't really know what's going to happen when this web of life collapses. Like when the entire biospheric interactions, when there's no more insects, we don't know how we're going to continue life on this planet, actually, right? The issue is that severe. The topsoil loss is like 40% or 30% planet-wide over the last 50 years. I mean, there's a widespread ecological crisis. So what I think is better is to think, okay, the idea of the Green New Deal is very popular, but what we need is to put our forces into play to figure out what those forces are, of course, and put them into play and say we reject the technocratic top-down models of a Green New Deal, and what we want to put in place again is a People's New Deal. And this is exactly what the Red Nation recently did. They said, okay, we want a Red Deal, and they put in place a certain set of policies that are much more radical than anything you hear coming out of, you know, the New Republic or Ocasio-Cortez or New Consensus or Elizabeth Warren or that's on the stage of the Democratic debates, right? And this is a very different policy orientation. It's not because it's not a policy orientation at all. It's a people's orientation based on building autonomous power and then using that, of course, inevitably, too, it's going to influence what politicians say and do. But it doesn't take what politicians say and do and their policy proposals as something that we need to reshape or remold and tinker with. Instead, it says, okay, what are our values? What kind of world do we want? Do we want a world in which most of the world has the right to food, water, air, which are the historic goals of some people who, or you could say development. Does most of the world deserve control over their own food systems? Do they deserve sustainable agricultural systems? Do they deserve to have systems in which their foods, their agriculture is devoted to feeding the domestic population? Do they deserve their own industrial systems that are sustainable and that don't rely on exploitation and imperialism? And what is our interaction with that? What do we want? What do we want? We want clean cities, and we want yesterday the ozone in New York was, there was an air quality issue. You know, I looked on my phone and it said that the air quality index was a 159. I didn't know what that meant. I mean, maybe I haven't been here in a little while, but yeah, it was very bad. I was like going, I took a walk. I could barely breathe afterwards. It's absurd, right? I mean, it's actually not a way to structure social, and this is the richest city in the richest country in the world. And we don't even have clean air on a summer afternoon, right? So it's also about what we want. It's not a question of saying, okay, how can we accommodate everyone else? It's like, how can everyone accommodate one another such that everyone has the right to all of these basic things, including functioning mass transit, good jobs for everybody, guaranteed health care, guaranteed clean food that isn't filled with plastics and chemicals and whatever else they put in place in our sandwiches. So the question is, how can we begin to orient to the Green New Deal in such a way that those interests are the ones that formulate the program, and then that program is what we use to fight for a different kind of future? So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Kelly.
I want to come back to this one piece about policy or politics. You know, through my work in Cooperation Jackson, we are in a lot of these conversations about, you know, with Ocasio and her crew and in different ways and folks trying to shape a number of different things. And I can just tell you, you know, on the serious side, we're struggling with them to take the issue serious. And for us, that means this can't just be a hook for election mobilization for 2020, which is fundamentally how it's being used and mobilized, you know, by her little section and wing, however it's emerging of the Democratic Party, just speaking frankly. And trying to put up a position with some of the forces that we align with, saying it's not just it's a matter of consulting with frontline communities or being in some dialogue with folks. Like there's a much deeper process that has to be both fought through and thought through in the course of the next 3 to 4 years, quite honestly, around how do we actually build and extend the concrete work around people building an alternative on the ground. And then, you know, I hate to use this word, but that there's a particular way of kind of scaling up and federating out so that the work reinforces itself, and then there's a level of both kind of movement building but also protection of the work so it extends and grows out. Because there's a lot of fundamental, you know, as Max was saying, there's a lot of fundamental projects, you know, here in the United States and well beyond, of folks who are without waiting for some command or some forces on high who are actually trying to experiment and build in real time things that are regenerative in nature. But they're not projected, they're really not connected to a great extent, and then fundamentally politically and ideologically not necessarily aligned. So there's kind of a broad recognition that we have to do something different, but it's not a clear sense of where the difference is. Like, where are we going with this? Where do we need to go? And we need to have a much deeper conversation about that. And I would interject, we need to start having a clear articulation around this whole framework around eco-socialism, right, with a stated aim and objective. And I think many people are kind of in the mass conversation trying to skirt that and just say we can do something different without shifting power, without shifting society and reorganizing society. That's not going to work, right? Fundamentally, I would argue with folks, that's not going to work. Like, we have to be clear about where we're trying to go and then put it in a deeper context. I think, personally, I think we do ourselves sometimes the injustice of just talking about it as, you know, climate change. We're in the midst of the sixth great extinction event right now. Right? And they are related, but they're not necessarily the same thing. And the piece around the sixth extinction event, there's no fundamental argument that the way we've gone about, and I'm speaking we in a broad generic sense, the way capitalism has moved on the planet the last 200 years, human-directed action, has basically reduced life on this planet in the last 50 years in particular, has been extremely severe. And then now this wall above, you know, the Earth systems functioning in ways that nature can't keep up. Like, that's a whole different thing. And to me, where it became apparent, to give you just an anecdote, like in Mississippi, some of the things that we've seen, I've seen just in my own little garden and stuff, in my own, you know, yard, was a couple of years ago, I think it was like 2016, the roses bloomed in January, right? They bloomed in January. And it's not typically supposed to happen until like March. And what that meant was the cycle of, you know, the insects which survive off of the set of plants that we have, they didn't gestate early enough. And so then the birds came a couple of, you know, like in April, where their eggs laid, and half of the babies just in my yard, they starved to death, they died. Because the cycle was just off. You know, one thing depended upon another thing, connected to another thing. And just that early bloom just threw everything off just in the scope of my own yard. And that is very much directed to how we've built our cities, how we've done this massive suburbanization over the last 70, 80 years, totally reduced, you know, all the various ecosystems in a constant pursuit of expansion, particularly the American version of how you build things out. For me, I think some of the things I've been talking about or trying to put in, interject in the conversation of late, thinking that we're just going to have a better version of this, like a cleaner version of this, is not going to work. Like, there's going to have to be a reorganization on a massive scale that I don't even think we fully realize. Like, what would a new urban environment look like that was regenerative? You know, what would transportation look like on a national scale that was regenerative? You know, the reduction in cars and transportation. How are we going to argue, particularly in this culture, with saying, look, we all need to get out of our cars, you know, more bikes, more public transportation? Most folks are going to read that as a restriction on their freedom, right? Not an expansion of it, but a restriction of it. So there's a deeper way in which I think we have to create and have a real political discussion and injection of real politics, not just this policy pursuit of, you know, let's get more folks to turn out for the elections to put a Democrat in office who then might put some policy proposals or some policy things in place that would tweak on the edges. Like, that's not going to cut it.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is The Green New Deal, a panel from the 2019 Left Forum with panelists Max Isle and Kali Okuno. From this point on, we'll hear excerpts from the Q&A.
I would like you to expand a little bit more on AOC and what you're talking about. I know she's sort of on the left of it, but what's your take on what she's putting out?
The proposal she put in place was very vague, but there were some specifics that we can point to that should be troubling, right? She's talking about community-state business partnerships. A state business partnership is not a left project. For me, that is a different kind of project. And what a state business partnership means probably is the state pays the cost and the business gets the profits and the people get the scraps, right? And then she can talk about frontline communities, but if the actual skeletal or structural mechanism through which she wants to put in place includes the idea of state business partnerships, that's not a left project. That's a project for governing capitalism. So for me, that's a red flag.
And even that, you know, there's a very explicit platform around exporting green tech that was very explicit in a major component of the program that she put out. So you marry these two pieces together, you get a clear sense of, you know, this is just a rearticulation of the military-industrial complex just with a green focus, you know, just to put it in some historical context. That's what's being kind of proposed.
So she would not agree with eco-socialism? As the way you've articulated it?
I don't think even we've articulated it fully. I think we've said, like, these are the things that must include, but a deeper conversation of what are the actual social relationships that are necessary to make that happen, that's a deeper conversation that I think we have some outlines of, but I don't think we have a developed enough practice to say this is what it would need to be like, right? So I think even that's a gap on our side that we have to put up. Now, in dialogue, she and some of the forces around her haven't necessarily been opposed, but they've tried to take a more, I would say, you know, concession to a realistic option. You know, what forces of capital do we need to kind of rally to be on our side to form the strongest political bloc that could get legislation passed? Like, that is more the approach. So there's been a vagueness of stepping back once there was some, you know, kind of criticism and some challenge. And they've been basically, was it Sunrise and New Consensus, and some of the folks have basically been on kind of like a listening tour that they've been orchestrating and planning out the last couple of months. It's still going on. And then you got groups like the Climate Mobilization that have been trying to work with Bernie here. And I think on Tuesday, they're launching kind of their campaign of calling for a national emergency to be declared around climate, you know, which is also a part of this. And so some of the dialogue I think that people have with Bernie, one of the things that he made clear, which is why I don't think it's necessarily going to go too far, is that he wouldn't sign on to anything unless the AFL-CIO was going to sign off on it, right? And most of the AFL-CIO, particularly the sectors concentrated in and around energy, are very much opposed to the Green New Deal, in fact. So you get a real sense of the mix of forces that she and then, you know, by a broader extension, we have to deal with on this piece, where that just the basic old school elements of a just transition framework of saying we need to stop the petrochemical industry, protect those workers by, you know, retraining them and moving them. Like, they're not even on that basic level of the platform. We're just saying we should extend this and it should keep growing. There should be more fracking, you know. And if you look at, like, just the contradictions of how, you know, the AFL-CIO responded to, you know, what was going on up in the Dakotas, you know, with the pipeline. Keystone Pipeline. I mean, took a terrible position on that, you know, fundamentally. So there's a posture that folks are trying to move them in a particular direction and get them on board as a case study, get them on board as a player in the game of how the Green New Deal should be articulated, far and above looking at, you know, groups on the ground in Jackson or New Orleans or here, because they see the AFL-CIO as an institutional player with both resource and a political reach in a way that they don't see us. So the concession is going to be towards that, not towards what the science actually dictates and reality dictates that we need, right? That's not where she and they are at right now.
So if we're going to survive this crisis that we're in right now, I don't see how that can happen without some role for the state. And I also don't see how that can happen without markets, because we have a market economy right now. My version of socialism is worker-owned and controlled enterprises. That's how I would define socialism. If you're not going to produce, you know, if you think you're going to abolish the state and you're going to abolish the markets, you know, then my question is, well, how do you organize production? You know, and I don't know what the answer to that is, but in a 3-year time frame, we're not going to abolish the state and we're not going to abolish markets. So the question is, what can be crafted in this historical context that could meet this crisis? And I'm wrapping up now. And I think that what's going to be proposed in this other panel is $2 trillion a year of massive green public investment, massive demilitarization of like 3/4 of the war machine, plowing that into green investment. And that should be a kind of vision of what needs to happen. And, you know, if that gets co-opted by Elizabeth Warren in a watered-down form, I'll be happy.
I agree that, of course, there'll be a role, realistically, for states and markets in the coming 3, 4, 5 years in terms of stopping the most severe impacts of what will happen otherwise. That's clear. And it's, you know, 99% certain that's also going to occur through some form of politician, whether that be Elizabeth Warren or Ocasio-Cortez, who has a different vision of the world than most of the people in this room. That I agree with as well. What I think is very important, and of course I think the Green Party has really done a great job in putting forward progressive policy proposals concerning the ecological crisis, is to make sure that we understand that these forces are essentially not very sympathetic to the vision of the world that people have generally in this room. So to have a clear-eyed assessment of what those forces represent as we enter the battlefield of trying to push for the kind of world we wish to see. And so I think, that there's a push to not clarify what those forces are in order to gather all the necessary support, essentially, to defeat Trump, right? So there's a push to water down or soften a critique of the funding behind most of these people, the vision of the world they have, the alliances they seek, to say, okay, well, it's not a very big deal that Ocasio-Cortez doesn't want to attack the petroleum companies, or it's not a big deal that she hasn't called for demilitarization when the military is like the second largest producer of greenhouse gas, never mind what the effects of all the mining it does on the overall ecology, right? There's a push to de-emphasize those critiques, and the people pushing that are part of the kind of like para agenda or the para apparatus of the Democratic Party. And we need to be able to identify that if we want to gather an autonomous group or movement or force of any kind to push for an agenda which will then, yes, be adopted in a modified and watered-down form, but that's life. But we have to be able to move accurately on the battlefield.
So just in brief, I disagree with part of that, the last part of what you said, whether Elizabeth Warren, if she does some watered-down version of it, then that's cool. I think that, you know, there's a real politic that I hear you expressing. But look, I think if we don't swing for the fences on this, we're gonna miss the boat. Because there's a way in which we know the intersections of this have the necessarily transformative potential, even in the public's imagination, that's been missing for quite some time. And if we concede that we need to let various sectors of capital actually remain in place and kind of dictate the outcome of it, then we're going to lose out in the end.
Just to clarify, I think that we need to have an independent political force pushing for exactly what you're talking about. But just as in the 1930s, it was the socialist and communist parties that pushed the Democrats to adopt the original Green New Deal, in the near term, that's the model.
And I reject that model.
Okay.
That's my point. I reject that. I mean, I think we can look at that as a particular point in what FDR and those forces did was save capitalism. Is that what we want to repeat?
No, we just want to save the planet. That's what we're trying. That's what we're talking about now.
Right. But in order to do that, we're going to have to get rid of the you know, all the major corporations. A green Boeing is still Boeing running the show.
Right. I mean, one of the things that we're proposing in the eco-socialist budget is to buy out 51% of the fossil fuel companies to be able to defang them, to prevent them from being able to, you know, stop.
I'm pushing us to so I heard that and I read some of that, right? We need to push deeper on that, because there's a limitation in our own imaginations that we conceding power to the corporations as the being the only vehicle who could execute anything on a mass scale. And it's still removing us from the equation of how do we actually empower people and build the necessary force on a productive level, not just on the level of we have some coalition politics which elects this or elect that. We got to think deeper than that.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is The Green New Deal, a panel from the 2019 Left Forum, with panelists Max Isle and Kali Okuno.
There's kind of two separate ways to address the question of inclusion of communities in the Global South in terms of how we think about an actual People's Green New Deal. I mean, first of all, there's the question of actual political instruments. Like, we need an international. And it's not news that the U.S. left is not in a condition to enter into an international. But nevertheless, that should be the aspiration, right? Which also means to have, there's kind of a revival of Kautskyism at the moment. And so this is kind of pushing against an internationalist politics. We need to be very clear that when we think about politics here, in all ways, shape, and forms, it should be oriented both towards a horizon that includes everybody or all the working peoples of the world, and that actually actively seeks to think about what concrete steps can be taken to build out from where we are to building those links. So, I mean, to be a little more concrete, you now see people actually discussing biofuels, right? And this is part of the displacement of the discussion from politics in terms of the constitution of building a collective political subject that's internationalist, or policy. And people are like, well, biofuels, that could be a good idea. But actually, policy is, in that sense, already deciding what the politics are. Because if you're saying, okay, well, maybe the biofuels are an okay idea, you're actually saying we don't want to work with Via Campesina. You're saying we don't want to work with the most significant peasant movements organized on every single continent of the world and that are that have the most organized working people in the countryside and the small peasants of the entire planet, because they have a very clear position against biofuels, right? So, you know, what that can mean concretely is, of course, bringing people, if there are forums about the Green New Deal in communities, to say, okay, why don't we have someone from Via Campesina? They're not talking about a Green New Deal, but they've been talking about using smallholder agroecology to cool the planet for at least 10 years, right? So why aren't they at the table when there's a discussion about the Green New Deal? Okay, then there may very well have already been a decision to exclude them from the political horizon, right? So I think that plays out locally or organizationally in a lot of different ways. But in the broadest sense, it's about making sure that any specific discussion isn't already excluding the Global South from its vision.
My main thing is that we aren't utilizing our imagination enough in movement building. And we stick to my opposition is not so much that is a reality that we're going to have to confront. But is it one that we should orient our politics to? See, I think the way Max framed it, like if you start off with like, you know, we're just going to build more electrical, you know, access, you know, and that's a way we're going to try to do it in some clean way throughout the world. All right, that limits my politics. I don't have to change many social relationships to do that. Right? So that's the deeper piece I'm saying. We don't have to change much. Because you can come up with a very paternalistic program wherein, let's say, Bernie wins and he wants to electrify the world by getting all the U.S. companies to go figure out a way to do electricity cheap in Ghana, or someone like that. Since you know, you mentioned it. We can figure out some way and finance it through debt that'll keep Ghana, you know, in the U.S. back pocket for the next 200 years, right? That's a program that could easily come up with very quickly, in some benevolent way. So is that what we want to articulate? Right? Wherein, like, you have a situation in Greece, or Greece basically now is going to be in the back pocket of Germany's to what? Like, to the 2050s by their own admission of the deal that they just signed?
End of the century.
Right? Like, is that what we want? Like, so if we don't use our imagination, we wind up engaging in what I call concessionary politics from the very beginning of our thinking. Right, I'm going to concede that I can't win, so let me get the best deal I can get out of the situation and then put off the real transformation further on down the line. But there's some deeper questions I think we do have to look at. So, yeah, I don't think it should be, for me, I'm not trying to subscribe anybody to a candlelight future. But I do think that there's a piece that we have to recognize is that if we keep doing what we're doing now, we're going to be living in a world of plastic. That's associated with having that small refrigerator. Still, that's not sustainable. So something different is going to have to be worked out in a way that it can't be more concrete and steel as the means of improving the overall quality of life. There has to be a different way of integrating ourselves back into the natural environment that I don't think we're thinking about enough. Except that, like, sometimes people want to joke, like, you want to be a hippie. I'm like, no, I ain't talking about that either. But I think there are some ways in which we have to look at the very nature of what we've produced in the last couple of years is toxic in the long term. Utilizing chemicals and chemistry and the way that we use it to build this civilization is fundamentally toxic to the earth and breaks down natural systems. So we have to do a deeper level of reintegration, is what I mean, and not just think we're going to have a bunch of this. Now, that doesn't mean to me, in my imagination, that the quality of life goes down by means of health indicators or access to certain material services and goods. Like, I think that could actually increase, right? But it requires a different orientation to Is the quality of life being able to access cable TV, or is quality of life being able to access all of you in organic social relationships? Which one is it? That's what I'm articulating. Which one is it? Because the easiest route is reproduce, you know, what people have in mind and as an aspiration is, I want to get to where America is. And I was, you know, challenging certain comrades internationally, like, I don't know if you want that. Because the way some of this has been built actually individualizes society, but we don't even get together, we don't socialize together, we don't mingle together. That's not the articulation of being a human that I think we all eventually want to aspire to.
I think it's also important that we keep in mind, I mean, first, of course, I fundamentally agree that, like, a project, we have to control industrialization. We have to not eliminate it, but it has to be controlled, and it has to be structured in such a way that there's convergence. So everyone on the planet fundamentally deserves the same level of industrialization. And we have to decide what kind of things we do and don't need in terms of industry. I mean, medical care, actually, a lot of medical care is superfluous, and a lot of it is bad, but there are certain things that we don't know how to make in non-industrial ways. And okay, we agree that medical care is fundamental. This chair is made of metal, even though you can make chairs of wood in a sustainable way that's carbon absorbing. I mean, this is just something very straightforward, right, that is structured in such a way that we've been presented, say, that this is what modernity looks like and this is what development looks like. Power, everyone deserves power, but I don't think we should say that the forms of development that have occurred so far in the global south and that actually generally elites have structured as the horizon that people should aspire to, that those are actually what development is. I mean, I work actually directly on the project of development and food sovereignty in Tunisia, right? And a fundamental problem, a fundamental obstacle, including in Tunisia, is convincing people, including people in the cities, that there is no developmental path that doesn't rely on restorative agriculture. Mm-hmm. It can't happen. And in fact, they're running out of water. The whole country is dying, right? Because of the path of development that was put in place since the 1950s and the 1960s, primarily by the United States. And so they put in tens of millions of dollars and putting in these huge hydroelectric dams that supposedly give them electricity, even though there still isn't enough electricity, that supposedly give them irrigation water, even though there's ways of producing irrigation in the countryside that don't rely on using any power and that rely on entirely renewable materials. So we need to, I mean, I think this goes back to what Kelly is saying, that there needs to be a discussion about what are the ecological effects of given technologies and how can that be thought of on a global basis without thinking, okay, we need to put people, give people candles. No, we need to decide where and when we can use industry and when we're willing to let it go because, you know, now our bodies are probably 10% plastic. Like, that's not okay, but that was never presented to us as a choice. That was kind of presented to us as, okay, this is modernity, take it or leave it, and take it.
There's a ton of work that's going on. Like, the level of experimentation in the here and now, is, I don't think, is our problem. Like, I think our problem is how do we all connect and form the political strength that we need to exercise a greater social force, you know, and engage in real politics in society. That piece is missing. But, you know, almost every city, I mean, there's like 10 to 15 between the co-op work, the urban agriculture work, housing struggle work that's going on here in New York. You know, there's a ton of work that's going on here. But I'm often amazed even when I come to New York, this group doesn't know about this other group. Or they're not connected to each other's work in any, you know, concrete way. So it's that space, it's that organizing that I think is missing. That is the intermediate step that I think that we need to take from the experimentation that's going on to building. What I meant by scaling up, I meant organizing. I don't mean some massive new factory or something like that. I mean organizing concrete people to say, okay, this is how we're going to connect. This is how we're going to resource each other's work so we break a certain dependency on finance in the form of philanthropy. Like, how do we do all of that in a particular way? That's the big piece that I think is missing right now. I live in Mississippi, which is controlled by the Tea Party. I wouldn't even, you know, just call it the Republican Party. It's the Tea Party in the Republican dress that runs the state that I live in. Now, why do I bring this up? Because by next April, when our next legislative session ends, they are going to basically cut off and make mass protests illegal. And it won't be the last state to do that. Look, that's a, you know, policies that have been progressively sneaking through states and cities all across the country since, you know, Black Lives Matter kind of picked up off the Picatero piece of blocking the highways and then what happened to Keystone. Like, this has been creeping up. And then Trump just recently said that he wanted to put some national legislation that would ban or put some major serious prison time on folks who protest, you know, pipeline extraction and development. Now, in most, at least on the state level, there's about 30 states which have the supermajorities set in place to make this law. That's something we need to realize. And so the game, the struggle, is going to take some immediate shifts. And what I was saying apart just about the 3 years, like, the right is already advancing to a place that for us to take definitive action to save ourselves is going to be taking place in the context of our actions are going to be technically illegal. And are we as a movement, are we prepared for that? See, that's what I'm saying. So a little bit more than education. Like, you got to educate people to the fact that this is how the right is moving to take preventative measures so that they kind of remain in power and there's no legal, democratic, liberal way of affecting change. But if so, our survival is going to basically mitigate it. At some point, we're going to have to go beyond that, right? We're going to have to go beyond the mere protest because that will, you know, just being out in the street against a pipeline might land you 10 years in jail already in some states, right? So there's a level of the here and now and the immediacy of we better open up our imaginations to think about social relationships and power very quickly because they are constricting the playground as it exists, the battlefield as it exists. And if we're going to move, we better be prepared, at least in this country. And I think this is going on all, you know, I know in Europe, different countries in Europe, they're doing the same thing. You know, Macron is putting forth laws, mirrored on the laws here and I think in Hungary that are, you know, specifically targeting yellow vest movements to say that, you know, this type of protest is illegal. So we need to put that, I'm registering as the element of real politics. We are going to have to deal with that and to recognize that they could make certain concessions towards, hey, if y'all go and we can work with the corporations and we can work with the politicians to set certain targets to change a few things and tweak, but nothing else remains the same. You can have a version of what gets passed, which could literally coexist with the repressive apparatus that they put in place. Look, I mean, in short, this is what I see in my work and what I argue for. Half the people who live in this country who are voting age and have voting access, which everybody don't, people choose not to engage. I don't think there's pure apathy. I think most people are like, why am I going to vote for the same shit over and over and over again? Whoever I vote, they're going to do pretty much kind of the same damn thing. And most people, I think, are keenly aware of that at this point. If we can construct a real option, right, a real viable option, I think people will move. So again, to me, I just put out that the tried and true things around organizing, you know, meeting people, figuring out what they want, what they desire, what skills they have, what level of coming together that they're willing to execute together and then act upon that. Like that tried and true, that hasn't changed and won't change, I don't think, in the future. And we're going to have to, I think, really get down and dirty on that. But I think the piece is, what's the vision and what's the program? And if it keeps up being a mirror, conceding to certain compromises, most folks are not going to go with that. Right? This is like, we know where that's ultimately going to lead. And it really don't have much room or space for me in it. And I think, you know, look, there's some qualitative shifts that are happening. You know, if you were to ask me in 2004, would something like Occupy exist, I would have laughed at you. And how quickly that changed public conversation and public consciousness to a certain extent, to where now we're still not having a direct conversation about class, but at least there's a conversation about inequality that didn't exist in the 90s that we weren't having. Then there's been social action and movement on the backs of that. So things are changing. I think sometimes we, like the grinding work of just doing stuff in 10s and 20s, I don't think we often see the qualitative aspect of it, that you're having an impact amongst more folks who just ain't gonna come to the meeting, but they are actually listening, you know, engaging and learning over a course of time. And then folks, I think, when their time, capacity, interest coincide, they will move. I think that's what we've seen, you know, on all of these different issues, you know, over the period. I think it's us getting beyond the pessimism of the present moment around how apparently ineffective and not our perception that we don't have a certain amount of power. I think that is a trapping of our own minds, actually, to a certain extent. And we got to break out of that.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is The Green New Deal, a panel from the 2019 Left Forum with panelists Max Isle and Kali Okuno.
I mean, is the U.S. looking like it's going to accept to go down gracefully in its control over the Middle East? Are the petroleum companies going to let go gracefully? I mean, this is the basis of U.S. capacity to spend. The U.S. consumer of last resort is the fact that the U.S. is able to issue bonds that people need the dollar as the, you know, currency of exchange on world markets and so forth. The U.S. is not going to let go of that very easily, and that's very much what Trump represents. But really, a lot of the Democrats represent as well, although some are thinking about other options. That's not going to be let go easily, and it's also not going to be let go. Furthermore, when there's no relationship between anti-war organizing and the environmental movement, and when anti-war organizing is actively demonized, right? If you want to move against the wars in the Middle East, you need to actually understand that we are at war and that those wars need to stop. Right. But in the current context, if you talk too much about the war in the Middle East, someone will think, okay, you are a supporter of the mullahs in Iran, or you are a supporter of, you know, Bashar. You're like, no, I just don't want to send U.S. weapons over there. That's it. That's my position. It's not more than that. And people, there's a lot of flak fired at one's position if one takes that position, which is very much related to what you're talking about. Like, we can't get rid of the petrodollar without actually the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region and the withdrawal of U.S. proxies from the region. I mean, I think that's very important. I agree in part with what you're saying about more democratic forms of energy. I mean, and it's something I've looked at a lot for Tunisia. You know, there's a lot of proposals for using dispersed forms of solar energy and using kind of artisanal manufacturing technologies to gather them. And I think that's very important for countries in the global south when they're choosing developmental paths. But I also think that that is the next field of battle, right? Mm-hmm. The next field of battle is who will benefit from a clean energy transition. And so you have Warren, you have China, and forces within China have different aspirations for their own society. Some of them are like, okay, China's going to use this opportunity to become the world leader in exporting clean tech based on the kind of mineral deposits that China has. And the U.S. is like, okay, well, we're not letting China take our place. So there's going to be a war over that issue, which again brings us back to the question of militarization, right? So I just think, you know, I don't think we can rely on technology to do our work for us in terms of shifting the social relations.
The fact that we're in this, even having this conversation is evidence that it's moving, right? And for me, what I've at least tried to make clear from the beginning, I applaud, you know, bring and make it practical. I applaud AOC for what she's trying to do. You know, she wasn't even sitting in the seat before she started introducing that. That's a major political risk within that framework that she took. And I think that she needs to be supported in doing that. So I can offer support and at the same time push you. Like, no, this piece, ain't going to work. I want you to keep talking about this, but I'm going to keep struggling with you over around how this is articulated, where it's framed to go. That's, I think, the broader perspective of at least, I'm going to speak for myself, of what I've been pushing from the beginning. So it's not like I ain't trying to, you know, deconstruction. Hey, I'm going to speak to the understanding of history that we know certain paths are not going to lead to everybody being included. And if we don't speak to that, then it's actually a fault of ours, not hers. So, you know, that's where it's at. I think it's moving. I think it's a step in the right direction. We just need to make sure that it drives a little bit further than the previous efforts at some this deal, that, this deal, this before. Let's learn the lessons of the limitation of all those deals and figure out how do we go further.
Demilitarization and ecological restoration have to go hand in hand. I mean, for so many reasons, both because of the raw requirements and also, of course, the imperialist system that the militarization both ensures and reproduces, right? So I don't think we can let that pass in the least. I think actually precisely it brings up the very contradictions that we're trying to address, right? It brings up that this social bloc she's trying to represent is arguing for a continued U.S. imperialism based on industrial export, and that is exactly the world we oppose. So I think we need to address that directly. I mean, I think the fact that she is forced, that this is the specific way she's crafting her policy package, speaks to how the card is moving, speaks to how issues need to be framed in terms of climate going forward on the liberal left spectrum, right? We're going to see a lot of reformulation of policies that incorporate the critique of the ecological effects of the current system while also saying, okay, we basically need to keep the social structures intact, which is why we see a lot of emphasis on basically a technological approach to climate change or even a technological approach to eco-socialism, where people are like, okay, we're going to do asteroid mining for eco-socialism. Right? So there's a lot of ways that the issues are being avoided, and I think it's important to be able to critique those while at the same time putting forward our own positive vision.
The left needs to be much more clear about what it does engage and when it does engage in anything, but electoral politics in particular. And that if our forces at least on, say, like a municipal or state level, if we're not there to really push what I call a protagonistic form of governance. And what I mean by protagonist is you enter into that force to heighten the contradictions in the interest of the working class and the oppressed, not to make compromises with capital or not think that you're there to manage the contradictions of capitalism, which can't be managed. Right? So, but if we don't enter into that space and make it practical, and what does that mean, practical? If you want to enter that space and really push your politics, you're only going to be there 4 years, at least in the current dynamic. And you should walk in there understanding, I'm going to push this hard with the expectation that I'm probably not going to be here 4 years. But that's the point, right? That I'm going to try to push the envelope and move it to such a degree that either I'm working my way out of office because the office won't be necessary, or, you know, I've heightened the contradictions to a certain point. I've moved the movement to another need and I won't be here, or I get voted out because folks don't like it. But I think that, you know, for me on the deeper, this experience that we've had the last 10 years, we did a number of things prematurely. And I think getting into electoral politics was one of them. So it's one of the things I think, you know, Jackson and us have kind of been noted for. We did this amazing electoral victory. I'm like, y'all not living with the consequences of that victory in the same way that we are. Mm-hmm. And the consequences of that victory is there's been a whole bunch of black people that have been killed by folks under the authority of folks who I once called comrades. And I spent a lifetime literally fighting against police terror, you know, as a basis of my political project. Now I'm confronted with my comrades being in charge of the folks who are executing that. But what do we learn from that? And then how do we articulate it to folks to be like, I think we've done some good work. I think we could have done better. But there's certain aspects of the logic that I think that we thought our way out of, or at least that what was implied, but we actually didn't. And I think that there's ways in which, why I was pushing on the comrade earlier, like, look, we got to broaden our imagination. And I'm saying, I was articulating that, just to be clear, from the concrete experience that I think I have of saying there were certain assumptions that were embedded in some of the thinking around where this society is and by what rules and norms it operates on. But we didn't look about internally how we have accommodated ourselves to those limitations as organizations and as individuals. And I've seen time and time again, well, we need to compromise here because this is what's possible to do. And well, I didn't come here to do what was possible within the confines of the system. I thought we agreed that we were going to do everything possible to shatter this, to destroy this, to move beyond that, not accommodate ourselves to it time and time again. So I think there's some deeper learning on this that I think we have to look at in the hearing now. But the only thing, I'll end with this. We are not having enough serious engagement, in my view, around how do we actually build strong social movements. and that should be in the lead of whatever we're trying to do as the real transformative power, not trying to put electoral politics and politicians as the leading force in what happens. Like, that's the wrong end. And, you know, as Max had brought up, like, are we having a conversation about politics, or are we having a conversation about policy? And to a certain extent, in this country right now, any conversation about electoral politics is really a conversation about policy. I was joking with somebody last night, but I was dead serious. You know, they were asking me about did I watch the debate with Kamala Harris and somebody else. And I said, no, I didn't watch it. You know, I read some things. I said, well, why, you know, you're a political beast. Why didn't you watch it? I said, look, let me be honest with you. Let me be honest with you. All they're talking about is how to manage the empire. I don't want to be in an empire. So to a certain extent, they got no bearing on me other than I just need to watch, okay, so if Kamala Harris wins, this is the shit I need to be prepared for that she's going to try to execute and force upon me. To that extent, I'm watching the monitor. But whether she's there or Bernie is there, whatever, the empire is the empire. But that ain't going to change. So it's like, what my focus is, I'm not, you know, that's the job requirement. You know, that's what you, when you sign up for that role, that's what you sign up for. So I'm like, I'm not really focusing on that other than, you know, are they going to, you know, shoot me in the head or shoot me in the stomach? You know, which one are they aiming for? That's the real concrete difference between them. You know, like, are you going to starve me or are you going to put me in prison? You know, like, which one of these two strategies are you going to employ?
So y'all all ready to go do some more deeper organizing, right? That's what we all walking away with?
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer and host of the series. This episode was The Green New Deal, a panel from the 2019 Left Forum. The panelists were Max Ihle, spelled A-J-L, and Kali Okuno. Max Ihle is a student of sociology and is active in the Palestinian and environmental movements. Kali Okuno is the co-founder and co-director of Cooperation Jackson, an organization that states they are building a solidarity economy in Jackson, Mississippi, anchored by a network of cooperatives and worker-owned, democratically self-managed enterprises. You can find Essential Dissent on YouTube, Facebook, and iTunes, and you can download the audio for free via radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net. Thanks for listening.